This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
I'm David Ronovich. Welcome to The Briefing Room, the space in the metaverse where you, me, the top experts, and a big subject get together for 28 minutes. This week, the moon is back. The first Artemis mission has been a success, and the next one should get humankind back on Earth's natural satellite. The plans are ambitious. Is this a new space race? And wait for it, are we about to see the colonisation of the moon? A month ago, the first uncrewed Artemis mission launched from Florida.
And here we go.
It's the beginning of a hugely ambitious venture.
10.
Hydrogen burn-off igniters initiate.
To get humankind back to the moon.
7.
To build a base.
6.
And then go to infinity and beyond.
5. Four-stage engine start. 3, 2, 1. Boosters in ignition. And liftoff of Artemis 1. We rise together, back to the moon and beyond.
But what's it all for? And who will benefit? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, we need to be briefed on the Artemis project, the mission that's happened and those that are planned. Rebecca Morell is the BBC science correspondent. Rebecca Morell, tell me about the Artemis programme. Who's involved in it and what's the objective?
The Artemis programme, it's led by NASA. And essentially, it's a series of increasingly complex missions to get people back on the moon again. So we've just seen the first Artemis mission, Artemis 1, and that involved the launch of the most powerful rocket that NASA has ever built, the Space Launch System, which sent a capsule called Orion up into space. That went on a 26-day journey around the moon and back again. This was a test flight, so no people were on board this time. The aim of it was to study the data as much as possible, because the next step is to get astronauts on board. So Artemis 2, astronauts are going to join the ride. They'll go on a spin around the moon, not land on the moon, and then come back down to Earth again. Artemis 3, the aim is to essentially to get astronauts landing on the moon and the first woman and the first person of colour to actually walk on the lunar surface. But there's an added extra step in this. So, I mean, it's quite complicated. So essentially, you've got the Space Launch System, NASA's rocket and the Orion capsule. That's going to take the astronauts up. But then SpaceX, Elon Musk's company, are going to be launching a rocket to Starship. That's going to be carrying a landing system up into space. The astronauts are in the Orion capsule. They join up with Starship, get out, get into the Starship landing system, and that's what takes them down to the moon and back again. So after that, if that's not complicated enough, the aim is to build a lunar gateway. So this is a space station which is going to be in orbit around the moon. And this is essentially part of the plan to build a permanent presence on the moon too. So on the moon, they'll hopefully have laboratories, they'll have rovers working, they'll have habitation units. So it's to build a lunar base actually on the lunar surface too. But if you've got a little lunar gateway, a space station constantly orbiting the moon, it's going to ease the journey for astronauts. It gives them a chance to travel kind of back and forth between the two and then back and forth to Earth as well. And the idea behind all of this is to get a sustained presence on the lunar surface. It's not about fleeting visits, it's about living and working there.
What is the timescale on all this?
The timescale is quite ambitious. Artemis 1 just completed. It's gone really well. Artemis 2, they're saying by the end of 2024. Artemis 3, the one where they actually get the astronauts down to the lunar surface, they're saying 2025. Lunar Gateway, the first little bit of the Lunar Gateway, should go up in 2024. The timeline is a bit looser for when that will eventually be completed, but it's quite an ambitious timescale.
It is. It's incredibly ambitious. So the question is it realistic as well as ambitious?
I think it is going to take a bit longer. The third Artemis mission, when they're factoring in this landing system too, well, Elon Musk hasn't completed his Starship rocket and he's going to have to test the Starship rocket. He's going to have to test the landing system too. So I think that the timelines might slip to the right a little bit.
Elon Musk has been a bit distracted recently. Can I just ask what sounds like a parochial question? Has Britain got any role in any of this?
Well, the European Space Agency has been involved in this mission. Britain is one of the partners of the European Space Agency. So that's what's quite unusual about Artemis. Artemis is led by NASA, but it's more of a collaboration with the Japanese space agencies and Canadian space agencies and the European Space Agency. They're going to be involved in building the Lunar Gateway.
There was all that business about getting tourists into space and onto the moon. Are private space companies still looking at that?
A Japanese billionaire has essentially paid for a mission on the Starship rocket to take a group of artists, musicians, filmmakers on a trip around the moon and back again.
If ever there was a plot for a disaster movie, that would seem to be it. Let's talk about the countries not involved in Artemis. I'm thinking of China and Russia.
Well, China are really interesting because in just a few years, they've gone from having absolutely no space program to a really quite impressive space program. So they have landed rovers on the moon already. They've sent a rover to Mars as well, which is no mean feat. They're building their own space station, a bit like the International Space Station, but just for China. And they've also got their sights set on the moon too. So they want to send astronauts there also. Russia are interesting because, of course, you know, back to the Apollo missions, that was all driven by the race with the Soviet Union. You know, they made great leaps in space, sending the first person up into space, Yuri Gagarin, etc. Ukraine has changed everything. So they were involved in a lot of collaborations in space, but a lot of those collaborations have slipped away after they invaded Ukraine. Countries have said they simply won't work with them.
Rebecca, I was a teenager when the lunar landing happened. And then there's nothing about the moon for years and years and years and years. Why is it back in fashion now?
There's still loads to learn and explore. But they're also looking at the moon with an eye to exploring a bit further in the solar system as well. So getting to Mars, for example, and you can't just go to Mars. It's really, really hard. There are all sorts of challenges. So why not work out how to get astronauts living and working in space for long periods of time using this sort of handy little place that's not too far away from the Earth, first of all. So it's kind of the moon's back in fashion, but I think people are eyeing places a bit further afield too.
Rebecca Morell. If you look at the Artemis page of the NASA website, it's full of motivational statements like, our success will change the world, and we're going back to the moon for scientific discovery and economic benefit. Well, what is there to discover up there? And what might the economic benefits be? And for whom? With me now in the briefing room are two space scientists, Professor Jack Burns of the Department of Astrophysical and Planetary Sciences at the University of Colorado. He's also a former member of the NASA Advisory Council. And John Zarnecki, Emeritus Professor of Space Sciences at the Open University here in the UK. John Zarnecki, what is on the moon that's of interest to humans?
Well, there is loads on the moon that should and that does interest us. Sometimes we refer to it as a museum of the history of our environment. The moon has been sitting there without an atmosphere and for much of its life without a magnetic field, and it's been bombarded by cosmic rays, the solar wind, you know, this stream of particles from the sun, and the impact of dust particles. And all of these phenomena leave an imprint on the surface of the moon and in the surface material. And these have been recorded. Unlike on the Earth, you see, the Earth is a very dynamic place. We also have an atmosphere to protect us, but we have plate tectonics, we have weather. So any record on the surface tends to last only for a short time. in astronomical terms. The moon, on the other hand, has preserved these things in some way. Now, we would love to get at those records.
So if we go up there, we can discover an awful lot still.
Absolutely. We have literally only scratched the surface. There's so much more to do.
Jack Burns, what other kinds of science could we do from the moon that we can't do on Earth? What are we enabled to do by the very fact of being on the moon?
One other topic is actually astrophysics and cosmology, using the far side of the moon. The moon is what we call tidally locked. One side is always facing the Earth. The far side is facing away, which makes it uniquely radio quiet. And so we can take advantage of that and do observations that are not possible from the surface of the Earth and explore unobserved part of the universe called the Dark Ages and the Cosmic Dawn. That's before and during the formation of the very first stars in the universe.
John Zarnecki, is there anything on the moon that might be worth mining and exploiting and bringing back to Earth?
Let me answer that in two parts, which is yes and no, meaning that there is stuff there that is of interest to us, I think, to exploit, but perhaps not to bring back to Earth. You know, though the moon might be relatively close to us, we've got this gravity well between the two. You know, we have to get up out of our gravity field. And also, if we're returning material, we've got the reverse journey, and that's tough, both in terms of energy and cost. So any materials there that we might mine and exploit actually might be more useful to use in place on the moon or in the lunar environment. And in fact, if we use the moon as a stepping stone for travel further out into the solar system, that's how I think we might more likely use these materials.
And what kind of materials are we talking about?
Well, it could be components for rocket fuel, maybe oxygen, hydrogen. There's certainly material on the surface that we could use to build lunar habitats. The dust, regolith as we call it, there have been lots of tests with similar material on the Earth, and we can sort of make bricks, if you like, to build our lunar stations. And that will be so much easier than carting all the building material from the Earth to the moon.
Jack Burns, that takes me slightly into the next question I wanted to ask you about the challenge of actually living on the moon, if that's what we chose to do, and about whether we could build some kind of base. Tell us a bit more about this regolith. It sounds like kind of Lego for the moon.
Well, it does. I mean, basically every mineral that's on the Earth is also on the moon. The moon is particularly rich in magnesium and aluminum and silicon. So one of the things my colleagues and I have been experimenting with, this project funded by NASA, is actually constructing radio telescopes, solar panels, cabling, using the regolith or the soil material that is on the moon. It's rich in all of these and would be a first step in learning how to live off the land.
Jack, what do you have to do to it to make it a building material if it's sort of just sitting there as dust?
You have to extract minerals. You have to extract aluminum and magnesium using a number of processes that are actually have been developed for years and years on the Earth. And the high vacuum, low atmosphere of the moon is particularly attractive for some of these processes. And interestingly, a byproduct of almost all of these processes is oxygen. So we will have an abundance of oxygen that will come out from the manufacture of components for habitats or components for radio telescopes.
John Zarnecki, what about water and power? We've just hinted there at one possible source of power, but presumably there might be ways that we would want to put power on the moon. But what about water as well?
Yes, well, one of the big changes in the decades since the Apollo era is that, you know, we used to think of the moon as rather arid and dry, but we now know from a whole variety of measurements that water does exist there. And the interesting place where we think it is near the South Pole of the moon. There are craters in that region where inside the craters, the sun never shines. So it is incredibly cold there, and ice almost certainly exists there. and we could probably exploit that. And in the same region, interestingly, on the rims of those craters, those are permanently in sunshine. So you could imagine a situation where you have large solar arrays on the edge of these craters, giving power to extract the water from the ice which is in the crater bottoms.
And what about these sort of portable nuclear power stations that people have got into recently? Could you take them up there?
You could, and in fact, you know, small nuclear power sources and RTGs, in the jargon, radioisotope thermal generators, these are what we use to power spacecraft that go to the outer solar system, where we can't use solar panels anymore. So these certainly could also be used. But my feeling is that the moon is actually quite a benign place to put large solar arrays, I mean, square kilometres even, to give us significant amounts of power. I mean, the sun does go down. We have roughly 2 weeks of day and then night. But, you know, that offers us great opportunities to generate solar power. No clouds, no rain to get in the way.
Jack Burns, can I just ask you about the effect on humans, if that was how it was decided to set up a base on the moon and humans were to be there? The effects on the human body of being out of gravity for so long, do we know much about that?
It's an interesting environment on the moon because it's different from the two places where we have experience, namely, of course, on the Earth and also in the space station where you have microgravity. On the moon, you have 1/6 the gravity of the Earth. So it's in between. You do have some gravity, but it's reduced. We don't have enough experience yet with the Apollo astronauts only being on the moon for 3 to 5 days. They really weren't fully acclimated. So what is the effect of partial gravity on the human body? That's going to be very interesting. The other thing that we have to be very cautious of is radiation. Because being away from the Earth's magnetic field, which protects us on the Earth and in low Earth orbit, on the moon you have a full dose of radiation. So protecting the astronauts, limiting their time on the surface is going to be important.
John Czarnecki, the idea behind Artemis, one of the ideas behind it, is to set a kind of staging post for further exploration. And Mars is the planet that's always mentioned. How much bigger a challenge is it going to be to fly on to Mars?
I would say that technically we could do it tomorrow. The problems are mostly, I would say, ones of political will. You know, being a product of the 60s and really an old hippie at heart, I still like to think that this is something that we can do collectively with all the major spacefaring nations working together. That would, you know, share the technical and the political challenges.
Jack, do you agree that this is more a matter of will than it is of whether we would have the capacity and the technology to do it? Because John says he thinks we probably do.
Well, I do think there are some serious challenges. Certainly, the first challenge is funding. People have estimated that it'll cost between $500 billion to $1 trillion for a Mars mission. And there are some technological issues. For example, landing 5 metric tons on the surface of Mars, which would be the estimate for a human mission. We don't know how to do that. That requires supersonic retropropulsion, a technology that we really haven't developed. Mars is much more difficult to land on than the moon because it has enough of an atmosphere where you need a heat shield to slow you down, but not enough of an atmosphere to use parachutes like we do on the Earth. So that's one example. Another is needing to live off the land from day one, including being able to manufacture rocket fuel to return. Those are very serious challenges that need to be understood before we're ready to go to Mars. My own opinion is I don't feel like we will be ready until at least mid-century.
John, do you agree broadly with that timescale?
I wouldn't be too surprised if we did the programme again in 25 years' time and the answer was still 25 years away.
John Czarnecki there with Jack Burns. The science and the technology fascinate, but there's a lot more to think about, such as who owns the moon anyway? Who decides what happens up there? Brevin Bowen is a space policy and warfare expert from the University of Leicester, and Joanne Wheeler is a space lawyer. And how many of those have you met this week? Brendan Bone, we've touched on the question of political will. Now, historically, the big rivalry was between the USSR and America over who could get into space first and then to the moon first. What can we say about who won, if anybody won?
Of course, the United States set out to put people on the moon and bring them back, and they, of course, achieved that. So in that very narrow tactical sense, of course, the United States won it. But it was very much a political prestige project. It wasn't something that was done for scientific or exploration purposes, but a lot of science was done along the way, really. But it was very much a political prestige project.
Joanne Wheeler, how much of space exploration is really about projecting power rather than, say, scientific advance?
I would say a fair bit. In fact, the impetus for the Magna Carta of space, the Outer Space Treaty, 1967, was the space race between the US and the USSR at the time, the two superpowers, and the prospect that one of them would precede the other of landing on the moon. And then the question, of course, what would the state use the moon for, the influence that they could exert on the high ground, and whether one state could exert a sovereign title to it, and that this was a grave matter of concern. And that projection of power we still see across the world. For example, states, particularly some sub-Saharan African states, looking to have a satellite as an evidence of power and status. But commercial considerations now, more recently, are also triggering this exploration and continue to do so, again, rather than the quest for scientific knowledge, for example.
Now, Jan, we've heard already that the Europeans and Japan are working with the Americans on the Artemis project. In your view, are we looking at a new space race between that project on the one hand and the Chinese attempts to get onto the moon? Well, in fact, they had a rover on the moon, but their further attempts on the moon.
In some ways, we are. Let me take you back in time 15 years. I was involved in the negotiation of the commercialization of the International Space Station. And round the table, we had Europe represented by the European Space Agency, the US, Canada, Japan and Russia. China wasn't there. Now, we tried to collaborate with China these 15 years ago, but attempts were difficult. Bring that up to today, and I'm liaising with China on a particular project. And I was asking one of the Chinese representatives, you know, where is this lack of collaboration coming from? Why not more commercial collaboration? And he gave me a quote. Military involvement in space activities, he said, renders commercial legislation difficult. There is no clear line between civil and military. And there is a need to clarify the basic position of China on international collaboration and space activities. And I thought that was very interesting directly from this Chinese representative.
We talk a lot about China, Jan. What about India?
India, I see close collaboration. There is a good relationship between the UK government and the Indian government and quite a few missions and collaboration.
Blenheim Bowen, what are the military implications of these lunar programs?
There are hardly any military elements to the lunar programs, the crewed exploration or the robotic exploration of the moon. They are very much exploratory and scientific projects. So what goes on the moon in our lifetimes really isn't going to have any impact on the actual military competition between, say, the United States and China or any other country, really. And that's in distinct contrast to what's going on in Earth orbit. So very close to our planet, where there are many thousands of satellites now providing very important data gathering and data communication services for military forces and economic infrastructure on Earth. But that's very, very different to a few people or robots on the moon gathering samples and learning how to live off planet.
So in that sense, we ought to welcome moon exploration as not being an extension of a desire for further military power and advancement?
Well, I think so long as there's no significant economic value to the moon, we're not really going to have the same kind of military interests follow there, because there won't be anything worth protecting or seizing up there, really. And so the competition that you'll have between China and America on the moon, if there is going to be any competition, will be very much about prestige and image, the image they want to present to the world.
Joanne Wheeler, you're a space lawyer, and I have to admit that's a phrase I've always wanted to use. Do you anticipate having a lot of cases to deal with as people decide Who owns the moon? Actually, that's a pretty good question itself. Who does own the moon? Who gets to decide what happens there?
We're already seeing quite a few interesting cases around the moon. For example, in situ resource utilization and the mining of the moon, stationing nuclear power sources on the moon and positioning a constellation of satellites around the moon. And much concern as to sustainable use of space, including the moon and its resources. And actually recently been asked this year to draft regulations on human habitation of the moon and Mars.
Who gets to decide who does any of those things and under what conditions? Is it the United Nations? Is it some other body?
That is unfortunately a good question. The legal status is very much an active issue at the moment due to plans for commercial exploitation. The basic law here is the Outer Space Treaty, 1967. Article 2 of that states that outer space and the moon is not subject to national appropriation by claim of sovereignty, by means of use, occupation, or by any other means. There's also no clarity around whether extracting and commercialising lunar resources is in line with these provisions. But an individual cannot establish property rights by claiming ownership of the moon. Only states have sovereignty. So in short, whether one thinks that no one owns the moon or everyone owns the moon, there is no state sovereignty over the moon. A moon is not available for ownership by a state, a company, or a private individual.
Okay, let me take a ridiculous case. I'm talking absolutely off the top of my head here, but let's imagine that you set up a little kind of moon colony. And then let's say some other country says, actually, you know, we want to set up our space colony in exactly the same place because it's actually a good place for various reasons. And we want it, not you. Who decides who wins that?
At the moment, there is no decision mechanism. And the Moon Treaty allows the right to collect minerals, the right to set up a manned or unmanned base, the right to place even nuclear reactors, isotropic generators, the right to land space objects, vehicles, equipment and facilities there. But there is no regime at the moment in regard to first come first and that equitable right to share, etc.
Blood and Bowen, do you think that's going to have to change?
I think as the moon may get busier over the next 30, 40 years, there's definitely going to be a greater need than there has been previously for different countries, agencies or private companies to coordinate their activities. So at the very least, the United States and China have to have some way to talk to each other on a regular basis about coordinating their activities to deconflict them, to make sure that you avoid the very scenario that you just mentioned. Or if there is, that they're able to start talking about how to resolve it.
Joanne?
We need to look at this colonization, etc., from the human perspective. And having some governance structures actually work with a range of people, neuroscientists, anthropologists, etc., in regards to that governance structure. But that also raises the issue is, if we have a governance structure, what about independence? At what point does the moon and Mars break off and become independent? And it is a question I get quite a bit, actually, in regards to the independence. And lastly, I come back to my professor of space law 30 years ago, who said, if we don't have guidance and if we don't have that regulatory protection, what happens if an entrepreneur creates a precedent that we don't expect? It's hard to come back from and it's hard to manage in accordance with international principles.
Joanne Wheeler there with Bledin Bowen. My thanks to them and to Rebecca Morell, John Zarnecki and Jack Burns. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Daniel Gordon, Kirstine Knight and Ben Carter. The editor was Simon Watts and the programme was mixed by Neil Churchill. Another edition of this podcast will be along very soon. If you enjoyed it, you can subscribe to The Briefing Room by visiting BBC Sounds and listen to the entire back catalogue. We have a programme on the power of Britain's unions, or you might like the edition about the recent protests in China.
Dance. It entertains us and it connects us. And in my second series of Ultima Buse's Dancing Legends, I explore some more iconic dancers who have been doing just that. Join me, Ultima Buse, as I delve into the lives of these trailblazers and pioneers who have changed the world of dance forever. the tap dancing duo who astounded audiences with their acrobatic skills. The Hollywood legend who showed her versatility across different dance styles on screen. We'll hear about it all, so let's celebrate the magic of dance together. Subscribe to Ultima Vuce's Dancing Legends on BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here. I'm the host of You're Dead to Me, the BBC comedy show that takes history seriously. Every episode, I pair up a top historian with a fantastic comedian, and we have a lovely, funny, fascinating chat about a different subject from world history. And in this new series, we're beginning with an epic voyage through the story of Homer, the Iliad, and the Odyssey. And that's with Kyle Smith-Bino joining us. And then we'll be learning about Francis Galton and the racist, discredited pseudoscience of eugenics with Desiree Birch. We'll meet many medieval saints in their bone boxes with Rachel Parrott. So if that sounds like your sort of thing, listen to You're Dead to Me wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you. Bye.